This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Good morning and welcome to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. This is Tech Talk Radio for Dr. Richard Schertz. I'm Jim Russ. Today we're going to have two profiles in IT for you. We're also going to talk about car technology and in food science, a look at what makes champagne bubbly. But first this.
And of course, it was a huge mailbag. Huge mailbag.
There's a letter
that
in
big.
Your mailbox.
Oh, yes. We got a letter from June. Dear Tech Talk, I have a BlackBerry and an iPhone with Verizon. Wow, she's covering all her bases.
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, I'm going to guess that she's a government employee. The BlackBerry is the government device, and the iPhone is the personal device. And I think in many of these secure agencies for the government, they won't allow you to bring BYOD. They don't allow you to bring your own device.
No, my sister works for the NSA. It's got to be shut off.
It's got to be shut off, yeah. So and if they have a BlackBerry, BlackBerry does have very good enterprise security built into it. She says, the coverage in my townhouse is not good. Now, I think she's meaning the Wi-Fi coverage. I've been told to get a network extender, and this should solve my problem. Of course, Verizon has one to sell. What's your advice on this so I can receive and keep phones in my I was thinking she wanted a Wi-Fi extender. She wants a network extender. Well, you can get network extenders, and they're available for if you're CDMA, I think. You didn't. Yeah, you're with Verizon. You can get network extenders for about $199, and what you have to do is you just put them up in your attic. Normally what happens is that parts of your house have poor cell phone reception, like the basement.
Right.
But if you're on the second floor or third floor, you can get good cell phone reception. And so what you actually have to do is place your repeater in a part of the house that has a good signal. So you can walk around with your phone and you can test what the signal is. And then you can place the repeater there. Now, the problem is if you put it, in the attic, when it's raining, it's going to actually affect the reception because the roof is wet. And so, if you want to get the very best reception, you can actually put the antenna because it's a wire. There's an antenna that goes with the repeater. You can put the antenna on the roof, but then you've got to have lightning arresters and all of that stuff. So I would think that you would just do that. Actually, I misread this email. I thought you wanted a Wi-Fi extender, so I'm going to also tell people how to do that. And when we have break, I'm going to go and look up. There is actually a network extender that I like that I have recommended in the past. I'm going to just pop on the web and get the specifics on that at the break and then fill you in a little bit later. But let's talk about the sort of the Wi-Fi issue, because many people have Wi-Fi in their house, and then they go down to the basement or they go up to the second floor, and then the Wi-Fi signal drops off and they can't get on the web very conveniently. And so they actually do have a Wi-Fi extender that you can have in the house without any problem. The Wi-Fi extender, it simply detects the Wi-Fi signal and then retransmits it. And it is a reasonably good solution. But there are other solutions. Now, what I normally do whenever I've got a Wi-Fi reception problem, I download NetStumbler to my laptop. And you can download that at netstumbler.com. And that will give you the Wi-Fi signal strength in real time. So then I just walk around with my laptop and I look at the signal strength. Sometimes you can just move the antenna or reposition the antenna of your wireless router, and you can significantly alter what the signal is around the house. Sometimes if you're down in the basement and you're on the other side of the furnace, you've got all that ducting. That's what cuts you off. And so you may want to just simply move your router so that you've got a better line of sight to where your device is. Also, the antennas tend to be dipoles, And so when you're directly above the dipole, you have almost no signal. It's kind of a donut shape, which surrounds surrounds the dipole, and there's nothing. You know, the dipole is just a straight wire, and there's nothing right above
right.
the wire.
So it creates a null right above
it. It's a null right above it and right below it. So you might be able to just turn the antenna a bit to get rid of that null.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I've done, because I had this problem, my son was down in the basement on the other side of the furnace. So I bought a high gain antenna, and that's basically just a dipole that's longer. The one that they give you normally is 4 inches. You can get a dipole that maybe is 8 inches long, and it could be 3 dB or 6 dB typically. Every dB of antenna gain is a factor of 2 improvement in signal. So if you get a 6 dB antenna, you're getting a factor of 4 increase in signal. So what I did in the case of my son, because I didn't want to use a repeater, and I'll tell you why I don't like repeaters for Wi-Fi in a minute, I put a 6 dB antenna on the router, and I simply bought one that had the same kind of connector that my wireless router has. Then he had he didn't have a laptop. He actually had a desktop with a card, and the antenna was plugged on the card. So then I put a 6 dB antenna down there. So that gave me 12 dB total, which would be a factor of 4, 8, 16. That, mm-hmm. So that was, 2 to the 4. So that was 16 more signal to noise, and that worked just fine. So just by – and you can get a 6 dB antenna for probably 20 bucks, 30 bucks. They're not that expensive. You just have to make certain that the connector works.
Right.
And then once you – so you put it on one end, do your net stumbler thing, and so you can sort of do some simple RF design on your house. Now – if none of that works and you have to get a repeater, you can buy a repeater. They're around 70 bucks. For instance, Netgear's got a universal Wi-Fi range extender. It's around 70 bucks, and you can actually set this up. You can set on your network. Now the disadvantages is that the repeater introduces latency in your signal, and for some gamers, it's a death knell because there you've got this extra device in there that means there's a delay in the network. And so for gaming, it doesn't work so well, so people aren't happy with it. It also slows the network down because now you've got another device which is taking some of the bandwidth because you're in the same – you have to be in the same bandwidth area. You've got different channels at different frequencies. So you've got two devices in the same frequency area, and so that means they're sharing the bandwidth. And so that it is a little bit slower. So I would prefer using antennas rather than extenders on that. And at the break, I'm going to talk about how to get a cell phone extender. I had a friend up in Wisconsin that was on a lake, and he installed a cell phone extender, and it worked quite well because he could see the tower from his third floor, but when he was down in the yard, he couldn't see it at all.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great question, June, and I'll finish answering that a little bit later in the show.
Yep.
We got an email from Linda Lane. Dear Dr. Schertz, many months ago through your Tech Talk radio show, you were kind enough to help me set up an old Atari system. Because of your assistance, I was successful in accomplishing the Atari hookup and subsequent hours of play for my grandson. I've encountered a problem with a ILITILI virus, and I don't know how to get rid of it. We currently have Norton 360, and also we ran malware bytes, anti-malware. Unfortunately, this doesn't seem to work. Your assistance or guidance in eliminating ILITILI virus would be greatly appreciated. I realize you've got a demanding schedule, but your help would be most helpful. Linda L. Lane. Well, the ILITILI virus is a difficult virus to remove. ILITILI changes your browser's default homepage to a particular website without asking for permission. It alters your browser's settings once it's loaded on your computer and redirects your site to other locations which have malware on them. And so whenever you enter in an invalid address or perform an internet search, it misdirects you. It also tracks your web browsing habits, records addresses of visited sites, sends collected data to a remote server. The idea is they were trying to get more pay-per-click advertising, so they're trying to direct you to places where you're going to click through and they can make money on your pay-per-click advertising. There's really no easy way to uninstall it, and it hides itself in order to obstruct its removal as much as possible. Now, I looked on this, I looked around on this thing, and one of the problems is it actually installs a rootkit, so it's not detectable. So you run an antivirus system. A rootkit is between the hardware and your operating system, and any time you make a command, that's intercepted by the rootkit, and it changes the results so that, say, you can't see the presence of the of the virus, and so antivirus scan actually don't pick it up. So you've got to actually remove the rootkit. Now, how they got rid of it on Windows machines, they actually had to go into the into the task manager, and you had to stop the program from running. And the name of it was random.exe. You have to stop it from running. And then once you've stopped it from running, you go in and have to delete specific entries in the registry. And so you have to go in and do regedit and do specific entries in the registry. So it's kind of complicated to get rid of.
Yeah.
And I think on the Atari it's going to be the same thing. The reason that your antivirus doesn't detect it is because of the rootkit. So I couldn't find a rootkit detector for an Atari machine. I looked, and so I may finish this email next week a little bit further, because I would like you to get back up and running with your Atari machine. And I couldn't find any specific solutions for Atari, and most of the stuff was on Windows machines.
Gotcha.
We got an email from Bill Connolly, gentleman. Well,
he's got our attention.
Very formal. I recently reinstalled my Dell Latitude with Microsoft XP Pro, storing all the documents to an external hard drive. Prior to the system reload, I had all the folders. I removed encryption from all the folders. Apparently, he had used the Microsoft Windows operating system to encrypt the folders. So in case anybody would go in and look at his file at his hard drive without Windows through an external program, they would see an encrypted file. Now, prior to he thought that he had removed the encryption from all the folders because everything showed up in green. No more file folder showed in green because that would be encrypted and they were all black. So then he deleted the old operating system after he copied all those files, unencrypted files, to an external hard drive. And then he reinstalled the new XP Pro, and then he copied all of his files back onto the hard drive, back onto the main drive from the external drive. But his Outlook PST files were still encrypted. He didn't notice they had not been de-encrypted. Those are the files, PST files. That's the format that stores all of your email. Do you have any means other than the National Security Agency for decrypting? Your assistance is most appreciated. Well, here's the problem. You do have a problem, Bill, and it's possible that you have a solution, that you may be able to get around it, but I'm not really certain. When you encrypt data on your computer, you need a way to recover your data in case something happens to the encryption key. You see, every time you encrypt data with your computer, it encrypts it with an encryption key, which is basically a character string. If your encryption key is lost or damaged, you actually don't have a way to recover your data. The encryption key is like a password.
Right.
You don't have a way to get your data, and your data is lost. So that means that you sometimes, there are some security systems where the encryption key is kept on a smart card. You plug in the smart card, and it will de-encrypt your hard drive. To make sure that you can always access your encrypted data, here's the key, and I'm not certain you really did this. You need to back up the encryption certificate and key. So if you did back up the encryption certificate and key, you can then simply copy that encryption certificate and key back into the subdirectory that stores all the encryption keys, and then you'll be able to read your files. Now, all of that is managed by a program called the Certificate Manager. And you can open the Certificate Manager by typing certmgr.msc into the search box. It will come up with the Certificate Manager program. You can press Enter, and you can activate it. That's certmgr.msc. They can use this application to import encrypted files or backups back into your system, and you simply have to provide the certificate location, and it will copy it to your hard drive, and then it will de-encrypt the files. You also use this program to back up your certificate key. Now, if you did not back up your certificate key, I'm afraid I don't have any real solutions for you. So, you may, and it doesn't sound like you did, so yeah. I don't think I have any good news for you, Bill, but that is a great email. But I do recommend, if you're going to encrypt in the future, that you use a certificate manager to back up your EFS certificate.
You are listening to Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, and now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
And today we're going to talk about Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Now, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz developed binary arithmetic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, binary numbering system, it's you only have zeros and ones. Binary comes from the root. It's a Latin root, binarius, which stands for two by two. So I guess all the animals went into Noah's Ark binarius.
That was really the beginning of the binary system. They just didn't know that. Yes.
That's right. Now, Leibniz, now the reason that he's on Profiles in IT, of course, all the current computer systems use binary. Without binary, we'd be toast. He was born in 1746. He died in 1716. Now,
wait a minute. Do the math there, Doc.
He was born in 1646.
Ah, okay.
And died in 1716. Yeah, there's a little hold on. I'm going to have to check our research department here.
let me check that.
Yeah, why don't you check that?
You Google the Doc.
You Google that.
Mr.
Okay.
Leibniz.
Now, Leibniz contributed, he was one of the, a real Renaissance man. He contributed to law, history, theology, politics, engineering, geology, physics.
That's a lot
of stuff. Yeah. Get this. At age 8, he began to teach himself Latin so he could read some of the research articles. I mean, if you could.
He was obviously wired differently than most people.
A few years later, he taught himself Greek so he could read research papers.
But remember, this was in the age when pretty much everybody who was worth anything knew Greek and Latin.
Yeah,
that's right. Now, he studied logic and was always looking for the universal language that could be used to describe all things philosophical and all things
physical. By the way, Doc, it was 1646.
Oh, okay.
And here you can see a picture of him with all his hair.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yeah,
that's quite an ugly...
Yeah. That must be a wig.
that is
quite the ugly look. You know? I don't know.
Yeah, they all pretty much wore wigs back then.
It's
not, I'm sure it must have been looked good for the time, but right now you look at it, and if you see somebody walking like that down the street,
I tell you what, he'd have trouble picking up.
He'd have trouble picking up anybody
at a singles bar looking like that.
He's got the hairband look going there.
Yeah.
Now, at age 20, he published a dissertation on the art of combinatorics, in which he sought the universal symbolic language that would reduce all debate to a calculation. Now, during his time in Paris, he became acquainted with many of the leading philosophers of the day. He read the unpublished manuscripts of Pascal and Descartes. Now, he felt that he didn't have a full background in mathematics, so he met Christian Huygens while he was in Paris, and he learned some of the contemporary mathematics from him. He continued to develop his mathematical skill. Get this. He invented differential and integral calculus as part of that activity. He did this independently, by the way, of Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton is the guy that we all know and love as the inventor of calculus. He did an independent development of this, and his notation for integral calculus, which is this little long squiggly thing for use for the integral sign, that is his notation. It's also his notation which is used for the differential, the D for differential or derivative. So we're still using the notation of Leibniz for calculus, although I think Newton did get most of the credit. Now, a dispute with Isaac Newton over the invention of calculation scandalized his life because this is what people were saying, because there was this big fight, that, you know, national pride between Germany and Britain. And the Brits thought, okay, this German is trying to steal the notoriety of inventing calculus from a rightful British citizen. And they found evidence that he had read one of Newton's unpublished papers and secretly got the idea of taking limits and infinitesimals from Newton.
Don't touch my infinitesimals.
Don't touch your infinitesimals, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, the... And then in 1703, now this is finally when we get to what's relevant to Tech Talk. In 1703, he published an article called An Explanation of Binary Arithmetic Using Only the Characters 0 and 1. He was still seeking the universal language. Of binary numeration, Leibniz writes, it permits new discoveries, arithmetic and geometry, because when the numbers are reduced to the simplest principles like 0 and 1, a wonderful order appears. With base two numeration, Leibniz witnessed the confluence of several intellectual ideas that he was trying to bring together in looking for his general characteristics, or as he called it, characteristica generalis. But also the theological and mystical ideas, because he thought zero denoted nothing and one denoted God. So he was trying to tie it all together.
Kind of a black and white thing.
Yeah. He even tied it back to some of the ancient Chinese texts. There are symbols in the Book of Changes, or I Ching, called Yijing. These are basically hexagrams. There are 64 hexagrams that consist of six lines on top of each other. The lines can either be solid line or broken line. And what he did, he said, okay, a broken line is going to be a zero, and a solid line is going to be a one. And he discovered that the 64 characters were actually a way of counting in binary. So he thought that he had uncovered the secret meaning of these ancient Chinese texts. So Leibniz actually designed a wheel calculator, the first calculator for doing decimal numbers. And, of course, if you're doing decimal numbers, it's base 10. You've got to have a wheel that rotates and has 10 places. He thought, well, why don't I just have something that uses an on and off switch and use base 2, on for 1 and off for zero. And so he came up with the idea of making a binary calculator, which would have been the first binary computer-like system, but he never actually built it. It took 125 years for binary arithmetic to be fully deployed into a logic system by George Boole. You've now heard of Boolean arithmetic or Boolean logic. This, but George Boole, 125 years later, binary was not put into computers until after 1946. The original electronic computers were all digital, base 10, and they would have counters in them. And it was actually John von Neumann in 1946 that wrote an article pleading that the next generation of ENIAC computer, this is the So one of the first electronic computers with tubes, actually used binary numbering systems. But after that, they did use binary, and the thing worked like a champ. And now the rest is history. Everything is binary.
It's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, heard over these fine radio stations, WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FMHT2 Manassas, and WTOP FMHT2 Washington. More Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University, and you are listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Profiles in IT Twinspin.
We're going to talk about John von Neumann. Now, von Neumann, Dr. von Neumann, was born in Budapest, Hungary in 1903. Von Neumann was the oldest of three children of a banker. Now, John von Neumann is known for his contributions to a wide range of fields, including mathematics, mathematical logic, quantum mechanics, economics, game theory, strategic thinking, and computer architecture, which, of course, is why he's on Profiles in IT. Dr. von Neumann was a pioneer of the modern computer. He devised the computing infrastructure, which is now known as the von Neumann architecture, which I'll explain a little bit later. And all current-day computers, computers developed since the mid-40s, have followed in much the same pattern after the von Neumann architecture, although recently we've taken some deviation with parallel processing, which I'll explain later. Now, he was quite a wizard. At age 6, he could divide 2 8-digit numbers in his head. By 8...
I still can't do that.
By 8, he had mastered calculus.
Wow!
By 12, he was studying at the graduate level in mathematics. So clearly, the guy had the head for math.
Yeah.
In 1925, he received his bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. And in 1926, he completed his doctoral degree in mathematics from the University of Budapest. In 1930, he joined the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study. He became one of the first full-time people in the School of Mathematics. Now get this, one of the other 6 was Albert Einstein. So it kind of classifies him in the level of person that he was. He published his first book in 1932 on quantum mechanics. He became a U.S. citizen in 1937, and during World War II distinguished himself for his work on weapons development, most notably calculating projectile trajectories and work on the atom bomb. During and after the war, he became an applied mathematician when some of the best engineers in the world were at Los Alamos trying to decide how to bring atomic fuels together quickly enough to create an explosion, or the A-bomb, as it became known later on. He developed a technique for the implosion of plutonium by developing what was called the implosion lens that correctly would compress plutonium. See, there were two ways to get critical mass. One way was to have two subcritical masses that were separated by each other and take sort of a rifle and fire one into the other one and bring them close together so when they were fused, they would get critical mass, you'd get an explosion. The other way was to take an object like some plutonium that was too large to be a critical mass and then compress it smaller and smaller and smaller until it had sufficient density to be critical mass. And that's what he did with the implosion lens, to sort of compress plutonium to... prior to the explosion. He did that through modeling. His work is said to accelerate the development of the hydrogen bomb. During the last part of the war, and this is where we get into the IT part, he was involved in the development of computing machines. Now, his idea, and this was an innovative idea, was to store the program, which is a sequence of instructions. You know, the computer program is a sequence of instructions that you want the computer to operate, into the machine as simply another form of electronic data. So in the memory, you've got the program in one part of the memory and the data in another part, and you'd have a number or a counter or a pointer which would indicate what is the next program step to be executed. Now, this was quite an innovative thought because before that point, they had the data in storage, and they would hardwire the computer to do a particular kind of calculation. And then if you'd want to do another calculation, you'd have to go in and change the wiring. So the program was in wiring rather than in memory. And so he came up with an architecture that would allow that. Von Neumann also was a strong proponent of using binary, because many of the computers up to that point actually were based on base 10 or digital, and you had to have a digital counter. And he said, look, our memory's got either an on switch or an off switch. Using binary arithmetic would certainly make much sense. So he pled for the use of binary. So after his effort, binary was really used. Of course, we talked about...
Last week we talked about binary.
Yeah, we talked about binary, which was proposed by Leibniz back in the 1700s. So coming out of his work in the electronic computer, he actually came up with an architecture called the von Neumann architecture. Now, the von Neumann architecture has four properties. Instructions and data are only distinguished through their usage, and they're both in memory. Memory in the machine is a single memory sequentially addressed. Memory is always one-dimensional. It means each is just a one-dimensional number which specifies the memory. And the meaning of the data, whether it's a floating-point number or a fixed-point number or a program step, is not stored with the data at all. It's simply there's going to be an address pointer, and the program is going to indicate what the value and how to interpret the data. Those four properties were in the von Neumann architecture. Now, after the war, in 1945, von Neumann drafted a report and a machine description that would lead to the construction of the next generation computer, which was called the Electronic Discrete Variable Automatic Computer, or EDVAC. Now, after the development, and the EDVAC was based on the von Neumann architecture, after the EDVAC, he worked on the electronic computer project at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, and he developed a computer called the Mathematical Analyzer Numerical Integrator Computer, MANIAC.
Maniac.
The Maniac.
I think he was probably looking for that.
I think he was working his way back from the acronym.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah. He developed the Maniac computer, which at that time was
called it Maniac.
Yeah.
Which was
yeah.
the fastest computer of its time of its kind at the time, and the Maniac ran on thousands of vacuum tubes because this predated the invention of the computer. Now, of the invention of the transistor, I should say. He was appointed to the Atomic Energy Commission in 1955. He died in 1957. So he died at quite a
really young age.
He died at only 54, and he had quite an impact on everything. But you know, he wrote a book on game theory, which was the application of probability statistics to business modeling, and that game theory book became one of the classics in game theory. I mean, it's still used today. Have you ever heard of something called the Monte Carlo method, where they model like complex economic events are complex. It's sort of a statistical method. He developed the Monte Carlo technique for statistical modeling. So he contributed to many, many areas. But the von Neumann architecture is what he is known for, and that's why he's in here, profiles in IT. In more recent times, we have deviated from the von Neumann architecture. We've gone to parallel processing, where you've got multiple commands being processed at the same time. And of course, the von Neumann architecture was a serial processing unit. So we've deviated from the classic von Neumann when we went to parallel processing. And also, in certain recent times, they have started tagging data and data types in the memory itself with the data. And that's also a violation of the classic von Neumann architecture. So we're evolving from it. But the power of that architecture, though, you know, it can be seen in the fact that most machines follow that von Neumann architecture, and they still do, and it's 55 years later.
This is Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. We'll be right back after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that guy right here. My name is Jim Russ. I'm sitting in for Dr. Richard Church today on Tech Talk Radio. Just a few moments ago in Profiles in IT, we talked first about Gottfried Leibniz, who developed binary arithmetic, and then John von Neumann, who used it as a building block for today's computers. Binary comes from the Latin word binarius. If you can tell me what that means in English, then you will win tickets for lunch for two at either the Escoffier at Stratford University, fine dining on the campus in Falls Church, or at our campus in Woodbridge, Virginia. In order to get that information to us right now, you need to do by calling us on the phone, the number to call. If you're calling from West Germantown, Maryland, 877-936-9333. East of Budapest, Hungary, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Professor Andrew Mitchell, our adjunct professor for call screening and prize distribution, is here standing by to take your calls on Tech Talk Radio.
You know, I'm not really a big party guy, but we went out to a party last night.
This sounded like it was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun, yeah. And, you know, this is a case where, you know, technology does create a problem. You know, these RFID chips for your car. You know, you don't have a key anymore. You've just got this chip, and the car detects the chip, and then it allows you to start it up. Well, you know, now when you turn into your car at valet parking, so we decided since we're going to a party, we'll take the valet parking.
Ooh,
yeah, and so And so, well, hold it.
Oh, there he is.
No, this is the deal. Whenever I am wearing a tuxedo, I do valet parking. If I'm doing just a regular suit,
what's the correlation?
I have no. I just feel like I should be using valet parking in a tux. I don't know what it is. It just it doesn't seem like I should be going down from the fourth floor of the garage and taking the elevator.
Your car's pulling up now.
Oh, there it is.
There's your car.
Oh, there it is. Well, this was the thing. So I gave the attendant the RFID chip, and when we came to get the car after the party, he of course started the car for us, and he had a whole pocket full of RFID chips. He started our car for us, gave us an RFID chip, and we left. Well, this morning we discovered he gave us the wrong RFID chip.
Of course. And so, then your car now sounds more like this.
That's right. So, you know, there's a case where technology is just a little too good. Now, I'm hopefully, so there's some guy there who couldn't even start his car last night.
Brother.
So there we go. I'm not going to really say where that happened, but it did happen.
Probably a good call.
It did happen somewhere in the area. Now,
was it in Northern Virginia, D.C., or Maryland?
Yeah, it was at the. Yes. It was in Northern Virginia. It was in Northern Virginia. Yes, indeed, it was not. And so there. Now, you know, I had another little small problem with my car. The automation is nice, but it does create a problem. You know, now they've got automatic tire pressure indicators.
Yeah, those is actually. Gave me a great deal of trouble.
And so,
what's the downside of that?
Well, here's the deal. So my tire pressure light came on. So then I started. Well, first of all, I didn't have a tire pressure gauge, so then I had to get my tire pressure gauge because I didn't trust what I had. And so then I filled all the tires in the car, and it stayed on. I went all four tires. I couldn't get the light off. So then somebody said, well, maybe you overfilled them. So then I started going around and letting the air out. I kept playing with this thing over a period of about 2 weeks, and I couldn't get rid of the tire sensor.
He's driving around on rims now.
Oh. No, and so this is what happened. So finally, I Mr. Tech Talk ought to be able to solve this problem. So I thought it was a calibration problem with the tires. So my wife said, did you check the spare?
Really?
And so I went in. Each tire has an individual.
Even the spare?
Yeah.
Is it a full-size spare?
Yeah. Every tire has its own sensor. So I went. This took a non-tacky. So I went back, checked the spare, and that was it. The spare tire was low.
You know, I admire you for admitting that on the air, that Mr. Non-Tech took Mr. Tech took Mrs. Non-Tech's advice.
I know. That's frequently
great.
What happens. You know, you get so involved with the technology that you overlook the obvious.
I wouldn't have thought that the spare was hooked up to the sensor, too.
It's wireless. I mean, it's a wireless connection to the car, and so there's a sensor inside of every tire.
Oh, really?
And it's a wireless link to the car.
I had no idea how they work. You know, that actually saved me from being stranded in the middle of nowhere. I was going to middle of nowhere, Georgia, to buy an old beat-up boat to bring it back up here, and I am just about to leave Atlanta, and the low tire pressure light comes on. I didn't need the gauge. I got out of the car and looked, and I was having a problem, and there was literally a tire place within sight that I pulled into and they fixed it.
That's a great
thing. Same tire lost air three more times on that trip, so I had the same thing happen and three more stops at tire stores. I wound up getting rid of the tire because it couldn't be fixed.
Yeah, that's really what you've got to do in that case.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that I love with the new technology, the GPS systems. I just love the GPS systems. But what I hate the most is when somebody gives you an address and it's not in the database. You know, because it's... These GPS systems, they're all they all have a DVD data disks, and the region is broke. The country's broken up into about seven regions, and it turns out these data disks are updated. They'll do two regions every year, so there's a 3-year cycle. And so you really may have even though you have a new car and you've got a disc that came out last year, the data for your region may be 2 years old. So it does.
And things change quickly.
Things do change quickly, you know. And so it is worthwhile to check the version of your DVD data disc and then see whether there's a new one out there, because you can get a new one and get the latest data, because I really don't like it when my GPS system doesn't work.
I go by the old analog mask.
This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. More of our show right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back. You're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University, and this is Tech Talk Radio.
Let's talk a little bit about home theater essentials. You know, the price of these big flat panel TVs has been dropping. And so now you can buy a huge flat panel TV for just a few $100.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Really great quality, and you know, and so, but now once you get the great TV, you might as well turn it into a home theater system. So, you know, what are some of the key components that you'd like to have? Well, one thing that I think would be useful, especially if you've got kids in the house, would be a game console, either an Xbox or a PlayStation 3, PS3. Game consoles are great on these systems. You've got HDTV. You can get really gaming that is almost surround gaming. It's great for the kids. So that's a very good addition to your home theater. You want a Blu-ray player because the old DVD players the old DVDs don't have the resolution of the Blu-ray. The Blu-ray's mm-hmm. got great high quality. You want a Blu-ray player so you can play high quality Blu-ray movies. You want a universal remote because you can have all these different things. And I'm telling you, I recommend Harmony. The Harmony Link is a great mm-hmm. universal remote. It's fantastic.
And you're not getting a check for them, are you?
No, I'm not. I just like it so much. I've been wanting a Wi-Fi remote system for so long. I mean, mm-hmm. it's such a natural idea, and yeah. finally Harmony came out with it. You need a speaker system, and speaker systems have really come down in price pretty dramatically. Don't use those tinny speakers that are in your TV. It's just a sacrilege. And so you can get they have these sound bars that basically use it's like a phased array, and it's very directional, so you can get like a Bose sound bar that fits in underneath the TV, and then you don't have to install all these five
right.
speakers.
Uh-huh.
It basically simulates four or five speakers, and it's really quite amazing.
Bose makes amazing stuff, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, it's really quite amazing, and the physics in that is, you know, these are basically acoustic phased arrays, and they can control the direction of the sound, or you could just get a regular sound system if you'd want. And sound systems have really come down in price, so you're not going to have to spend that much for it. And then you need media streaming because you're going to want Netflix movies. I mean, why spend all that money for a cable connection when you can just stream Netflix for like $10 a month? That's what my son does. He streams. He's got a Netflix account. He streams stuff to his iPhone.
Really?
As well as to his home theater at home. And so he streams Netflix to his iPhone, and he does that because he's on my data plan.
And you're still paying for it.
And I'm still paying for it, yeah.
Right.
But he has unlimited data.
Uh-huh.
But
it's the only way to go.
I'm going to be weaning him off the data plan on the next.
He's married now, right?
I know, the next cycle. That's always the last things to go, is getting the kids off the data plan.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so it's always a serious.
And then they figure out how much it costs.
That's right. Well, son, I'm sorry, but I feel your pain.
He's on fire today, folks.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some headphones under $50. I mean, the other thing is, you know, you get these MP3 players, you get some nice devices. Would be good to have some nice high-quality earphones.
Sure.
Panasonic's got one called ErgoFit. They're only about $10. Pretty nice high-quality devices, Panasonic ErgoFit. There's another earbud that's very high-quality, ME Electronics, the A151. They're around $50. That's kind of an expensive one, but it is extremely high-quality. Now, if you want something that goes over the ear, they've got the COS Porta Pro. It's over-the-ear phone. It folds up. It's around $40. It's very nice because it folds up into a nice compact thing if you have to travel with it. So COS Porta Pro is a great one to travel with. If you want to go for something higher end but still under $50, Audio Technica ATHM30 is good at around $50. Very comfortable. But these are really big, so people know you're really listening to serious music when you wear those. Or the one that CNET recommended as the best headphone under $50, it's around $40, is the Panasonic RP-HTX7. Panasonic RP-HTX7, that was the best over-the-ear earphone under $50, and I'd certainly recommend that.
Tech Talk Radio continues in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Yeah. Now it's time for the food science section.
Yeah.
And I talked earlier about my really unfortunate experience at a wine tasting where they brought out all 13 bottles of wine and they had been previously opened and they were oxidized.
Uh-oh.
And when wine oxidizes, the aroma changes, the flavor changes, the color might change.
And not for the better.
Not for the better. And it does affect the consumer's ability to enjoy the wine properly.
Meaning you.
Meaning me. I did not,
and we know how Doc likes his wine.
I did not enjoy that wine that much. I did drink all 13 samples because, well... I didn't want to waste it.
Of course not. You paid $4.50.
I paid for it, and
we're going to drink it all.
I'm going to suffer through it. Now, wine can oxidize in as little as 2 to 8 hours, and the oxidation depends on the type of wine, how quickly it will oxidize once you open the bottle. Now, there are various ways to keep wine preserved. Primarily, these all revolve around trying to keep it away from oxygen.
Uh-huh.
That's the key. Now, the cheapest way to do it, I've never done this, but, you know, some people might do it, is that you drink half a bottle of wine, and then if you cork it, then you've got air in the top half of the bottle.
Yeah.
So some people simply have a half bottle of wine, and they pour the wine into a smaller bottle so there's no air at the top.
That's
and then they cork
idea.
That. So they rebottle it. So they have various size bottles, and they just rebottle the wine with a smaller bottle. And you just keep those bottles around. I really have never done that, but I suppose you could do that. Now, other people have, this is an idea that I don't know if I'd do this. They just drop marbles in the wine and they bring the level up to the top of the bottle.
First of all, let's make sure the marbles are clean.
You want to make sure the marbles are. And the problem is then when you pour out your wine, a marble may fall into the wine glass. I'm thinking this is more like a kid's way to do it.
That sounds like a kid's way of messing up a good evening is what it sounds like.
But you see, you know, I'm sorry, have you lost your marbles? I mean,
In your wine glass. Well, here's what I can see the marbles doing. The marbles then, because they're heavier, go to the neck, and then you can't get any wine out of them.
I know. So, but I'm giving all the options.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Kind of, it's a trade-off here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also, for $10, you could buy a spray of an inert gas.
Mm-hmm.
It could be argon, it could be nitrogen, and this spray has like a little tube in it. And so what you do is, after you use the bottle of wine, you just spray a little bit of gas in the bottle and then cork it. And now the spray or the argon gas is heavier than air, so it settles on top of the wine and it isolates it from the oxygen.
It's a protective barrier between the wine, and that's pretty neat.
That's right. Now this will extend the life of a bottle of wine for up to a week.
Wow.
Now my problem, Jim, wine never lasts in my house a week.
I've noticed that.
See, I mean, I
see that when I get the outline for the show, and there's typos.
I don't really need to keep a bottle of wine around for a week. But for those of you that, if you drink, say, one glass, and there are 4.5 glasses in a bottle of wine. So mm-hmm. I guess if you'd have one glass a day.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.
If you have 4.5 glasses of wine a day,
Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
I've got the vacuum. I've never tried the marbles. Or I've never tried the rebottling.
I think we need to do that in the studio one day and see how that works.
That's right.
What do you think?
Well, we could do that. Now
we need to bring it into the laboratory.
We should. Now the vacuum pump, $15 to $40, and you basically pump it out, and it pulls out most of the oxygen, but not all of the oxygen. So it doesn't really keep the wine for a week, but it keeps it for a few days.
Uh-huh.
And so I've got a little pump sometimes, and I'll pump out my wine. But
pump out your wine.
And I don't need it to last a week. But but it does help if, you can pump the oxygen off the wine, and it will, the next day it tastes just as good.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. Those are some low-cost ways to preserve wine. You can also get more expensive argon gas systems that actually put the argon gas in. They stay there in the cap, and you could pour it out, and these are used by some restaurant systems. But all of them revolve around keeping the oxygen away from the wine.
And finally this from Tech Talk Radio.
Bonjour. My name is Sherry. I live in Paris, France, and listen to Tech Talk via podcast. So great. We have got an overseas Tech Talk listener. I have a seasonal food science question for you. What makes the bubbles in champagne? How is it that they seem to come out of nowhere? How is it the bubbles never seem to stop? Why does this work better in a fluted glass rather than any other type of barware?
Uh-huh.
Obviously, Cherie has been doing some research.
She's been dipping into the booze, I think.
That's right. Best regards and Happy New Year from your biggest fan across the pond, Cherie.
But wait, there's more.
I know.
Isn't there more? You're not going to read that on the air.
Okay, no, we can't read that on the air.
Oh, sure you can.
Okay, by the way, you guys have the sexiest voices of any announcers on Federal News Radio. Whoa!
Hello!
Are you as hot as you sound? May we get an autographed picture? Hey, is Federal News Radio sending out autographed pictures of the Tech Talk
only
boys?
Only if we're taking them, I guess.
Well, Cherie, bubbles in champagne are an interesting question.
Yes, they
are. Actually are dissolved carbon dioxide gas, which is coming out of the liquid. Now, it turns out they start out as strings of bubbles that rise in pairs, and they gradually transition to bubbles in groups of three or so, and then they finally settle down to a pattern of regularly spaced individual bubbles. Now, it turns out that these bubbles arise from nucleation points on the glass wall.
Imperfection,
imperfections in the glass wall. That's why the fluted glass tends to be a little bit better, because it has more imperfections around those creases. Now, the nucleation points are small defects in the glass that trap vibrating pockets of carbon dioxide. Dissolved gas in the champagne gradually collect in the vibrating bubbles inside the defect, causing it to grow and soon expel gas from the defect. And so it starts out there, and then you see a string of them, and gradually they start coming out
everywhere. And that's why they just keep going and going and going.
That's right. There's a lot of research on, looking at bubbles coming out of dissolved gases, because nitrogen bubbles that grow in blood vessels cause the bends. So they want to study a nucleation of this sort of dissolved gases coming out of a liquid. But that was an excellent question, Sheree. And I'm telling you, I spent a lot of time watching those bubbles.
I bet you did.
So I did a lot of research of that over this last New Year's.
I spent a little bit of time myself doing just the same thing.
That's right. And they're still looking at bubbles.
That's it for this week. See it next year on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers. As indicated, Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.